from New York, this is Democracy Now!
Once we saw the actual initial reports, we just started realizing that there was benzene being emitted. There was lead in the air. I was already getting warnings that there were many more potential toxic exposures.
When we heard Christy Todd Whitman get on TV and say air quality is safe, we were horrified.
The concentrations are such that they don't pose a health hazard. We're going to make sure everybody's safe.
9/11's unsettled dust. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. We look at an enraging new documentary on the impact of the toxic, cancer-causing smoke and dust that hung over Ground Zero, sickening so many. Yet how the Environmental Protection Agency told people the air was safe to breathe. Were they trying to save Wall Street? We'll speak with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, who helped expose the public health crisis despite intense pressure not to. And we'll talk to a student whose school, Stuyvesant High, near the site, reopened before the smoke had stopped burning. We'll also look at how 9/11 responders had to fight for health care justice while they were sick and dying. We'll speak with Joe Zadroga, the father of police detective James Zadroga, who died of a respiratory illness after assisting in rescue efforts at Ground Zero, about how he had to fight to get his illness recognized.
Treated him terrible. Department refused to admit that he was sick, and they just persecuted him, and they wouldn't give up. They wanted him to quit. They would send a sergeant to the house to make sure he was in the house, because they were hoping to catch him outside the house where they could discipline him and probably fire him. That's how much they wanted to get rid of him, to say that he wasn't sick.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Unemployment benefits for millions of U.S. workers expired on Labor Day after President Biden declined to press the Democratic-led Congress to extend assistance, even as many states suffer their worst surge of the pandemic. An estimated 9.3 million jobless workers lost benefits, along with 26 members of their households who relied on their income. The cutoff of aid came after the Labor Department reported the U.S. economy added just 235,000 jobs in August, a significant slowdown due largely to the spread of the Delta coronavirus variant. The unemployment rate for African Americans rose 0.6 percentage points in August to 8.8%. On Labor Day, President Biden met with members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in Wilmington, Delaware, shaking hands and posing for selfies. Across the United States, at least 1,000 schools in 35 states have canceled in-person classes since the start of the school year, with tens of thousands of students forced to quarantine due to community spread of coronavirus. A disproportionate number of closures have come in the Deep South, where vaccination rates are lowest and public health measures in schools are lax to non-existent. Cases are rising fastest in school districts where students have been back in classrooms for weeks. The U.S. is now averaging over 1,500 COVID-19 deaths and 150,000 positive tests per day. In Idaho, Republican Governor Brad Little said hospitals are preparing to adopt crisis standards of care, with medical workers set to ration care as hospitals fill beyond capacity with COVID-19 patients. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has claimed control of Panjshir Valley, the last holdout of anti-Taliban forces. A spokesman said the Taliban was in the final stages of forming a new government with an announcement expected shortly. He denied reports of infighting and a power struggle within the Taliban ranks. Meanwhile, attacks on Afghan women are continuing to escalate. Witnesses in the central Ghor province said Taliban militants beat a female police officer in front of her family Saturday before fatally shooting her. In Kabul, protesters and journalists were assaulted Saturday at a rally demanding equal rights. protesters said Taliban soldiers blocked them from marching on to the presidential palace.
Together with a group of our colleagues, we wanted to go near a former government office for a protest. But before we got there, the Taliban hit women with electric tasers, and they used tear gas against women. They also hit women on the head with a gun magazine, and the women became bloody. There was no one to ask why.
The World Health Organization warns more than 2,000 health care centers across Afghanistan may soon be forced to close, at least temporarily, because their donors are barred from working with the Taliban. This is WHO Regional Emergency Director Rick Brennan.
That will be associated with an increase in illness and death, we would expect, and also rolling back the tremendous health gains of the last 20 years.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. is negotiating with the Taliban for the safe passage of U.S. citizens, and some Afghans are to leave aboard charter flights. A team of engineers from Qatar is working with the Taliban to restore service to Kabul's main airport. Domestic flights have resumed, but international civilian flights remain on hold due to damage to the airport's radar and navigation systems. The UN World Food Program has published disturbing new footage of the humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The footage, which was recorded in August, showed an emergency food distribution site with supplies being loaded on camels and brought to a remote area of Tigray that had been cut off from aid for months. This comes as the United Nations continues to warn millions of people are on the brink of famine, saying an estimated 100 trucks of aid need to be entering Tigray each day to meet people's urgent needs. This is a resident of Tigray who was displaced by the months-long conflict that started in November.
I couldn't sleep at night and think straight at day, thinking about what to feed my kids. I still think about how to provide for my kids.
In Guinea, an army colonel said Sunday he had dissolved the government of President Alpha Conde following reports of a gun battle near the presidential palace, spiraling the West African nation into political uncertainty. On Sunday, pictures surfaced of Conde in the custody of men wearing military attire. Meanwhile, Guinea government officials have been banned from leaving the country. This is Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, the coup leader.
The committee wants to reassure our economic and financial partners of the normal continuation of activities in the country. Mining companies are asked to continue their activities. The maritime borders will stay open for the export of mining products. The curfew in mining areas is lifted in order to continue producing.
Conde was a year into a contested third term. He won after he made changes to the constitution, allowing him to run for re-election. In Brazil, millions of supporters of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro are expected to take to the streets today on Brazil's Independence Day, triggering fears from opponents of political potential chaos and violence. Ahead of the massive march, over 150 lawmakers, academics, and former government officials from around the world wrote a letter saying they fear Bolsonaro and allies, which include white supremacist groups and military police, may be seeking to instigate a Trump-like insurrection or military coup. Polls show more than half of Brazilians wouldn't vote for Bolsonaro in next year's election. Their letter read in part, quote, "The people of Brazil have struggled for decades to secure democracy from military rule. Bolsonaro must not be permitted to rob them of it now," it said. Meanwhile, ruling from the Brazilian Supreme Court's expected soon on a case that could determine if thousands of Brazil's indigenous people can reclaim ancestral lands stolen from them. In Mexico, immigration and security forces violently blocked the passage of hundreds of asylum seekers in the southern state of Chiapas who hoped to reach the U.S. for refuge. The caravan was largely made up of Central American and Haitian families. In more immigration news, the Biden administration's once again deporting asylum seekers to Guatemala City by air, marking a possible end to the practice of expelling asylum seekers to a remote jungle in the Guatemala-Mexico border. This is an asylum seeker who was deported to Guatemala last week.
For now, we lost, and it's not worth crying over because the trip cost us money. We didn't leave with our own money, but with borrowed money. It's a harsh situation because things are very hard here. We lost. We need to carry on here in Guatemala, take any jobs we can find, because life is hard here. We were unexpectedly deported for wanting to live the American dream.
Parts of Louisiana remain underwater more than a week after Hurricane Ida struck as one of the most powerful storms ever to hit the United States. More than 600,000 electricity customers in Louisiana still have no power. The storm's death toll rose over the weekend to at least 63. At least 50 deaths came in the northeastern U.S. as Ida's remnants brought record rainfall and flash flooding. President Biden's visiting storm-ravaged areas of New York and New Jersey today. Nearly one in three U.S. residents live in a county hit by a weather disaster in the past 3 months. That's according to a Washington Post analysis of federal disaster declarations. The Post reports that 64% live in places that experienced a multi-day heat wave. On Sunday, more than 220 health journals around the world published a joint editorial demanding urgent action to keep average global temperature increases below 1.5 degrees centigrade. In Minnesota, progressive congresswomen of color have joined the fight against Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline, demanding President Biden intervene to halt the project. If completed, Line 3 would carry more than 750,000 barrels of Canadian tar sands oil a day through indigenous land and fragile ecosystems. Minnesota's Ilhan Omar led a rally by congress members known as the Squad.
They want to prioritize corporate profit over the lives of indigenous women and the future of our planet. Joe Biden promised to be the climate president, and this is his opportunity to follow through.
Michigan officials are urging hundreds of families to evacuate their homes near a Detroit area Ford Motor plant after 1,400 gallons of gasoline leaked into city sewers. The Wayne County Health Department says there's little risk of an explosion, but residents are at risk from toxic benzene fumes that can cause cancer. In Lakeland, Florida, a former U.S. Marine sniper carrying multiple guns and wearing full-body armor targeted a family apparently at random early Sunday morning, killing four people in their own home. Among the dead was a mother and a three-month-old baby she was cradling. An 11-year-old girl who was shot seven times survived. The shooter also killed the family's dog. The gunman, 33-year-old Brian Riley, was wounded during an intense gun battle with police and arrested. Riley was deployed as a Marine sharpshooter in both Iraq and Afghanistan between 2008 and 2010. Riley's girlfriend said he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. He had a concealed weapon license and was working as a security contractor. Actor Michael K. Williams, best known for bringing to life the character of Omar Little on HBO's acclaimed series The Wire, has died. He was 54 years old. Williams was found unresponsive in his Brooklyn apartment Monday afternoon. His death is being investigated as a potential drug overdose. In a 2017 interview with the New York Times, Williams opened up about his struggles with substance abuse. He said, quote, "Addiction doesn't go away. It's an everyday struggle for me, but I'm fighting," unquote. And legendary Greek composer Mikis Theodorakis has died at the age of 96. His popular songs and music, including the scores for the movies Zorba the Greek and Z, were banned during the military dictatorship of the 60s and 70s in Greece. And Theodorakis spent much of his 3 years of banishment in a remote village and in prison. And in Mexico City, a statue of Christopher Columbus that was removed last year will be replaced by a statue of an indigenous woman. Mexico City's mayor, Claudia Sheinbaum, made the announcement Monday.
It is a great recognition of the 500 years of resistance by indigenous women in our country. This is for them. We owe them and the history of our country, of our homeland.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, 9/11's unsettled dust. Yes, this week marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. We look at an enraging new documentary on the impact of the toxic, cancer-causing smoke and dust that hung over Ground Zero, and how the Environmental Protection Agency, were they protecting Wall Street, told people the air was safe to breathe. Stay with us. The Partisans by Mikis Theodorakis. The Greek dissident was imprisoned for years, famous for the musical scores of Zorba, Z, and so much more. He died this weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we're going to start with a warning to our listeners and viewers. Today's show includes graphic images and descriptions, some that you may certainly have heard and seen before. Yes, this week marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center towers in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., that killed nearly 3,000 people. We'll never know exactly how many people, because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death, perhaps the undocumented workers around the area. But we begin our coverage looking at the impact of the toxic cancer-causing smoke and dust that hung over Ground Zero in Manhattan as the fire burned for 100 more days. At the time, the Environmental Protection Agency told people who worked at the site and lived and went to school near it that the air was safe to breathe. In the years that followed, more than 13,200 first responders and survivors have been diagnosed with a variety of cancers and chronic respiratory and gastrointestinal illnesses. At least, well, close to 1,900 first responders, survivors and workers who recovered bodies and cleaned up the wreckage have since died from illnesses, many of them linked to their time at Ground Zero. For the whole hour, we're looking at an enraging new documentary that exposes the massive environmental and public health crisis caused by the 9/11 attack and how politicians and the EPA head, Christine Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey, put Wall Street's interests before public health in the aftermath. It also shows how 9/11 responders and survivors had to fight for health care justice while they were sick and dying, going to Washington scores of times in wheelchairs, on crutches, with oxygen. Yes, tons of toxic dust fell on New York City 9/11. While concentrated in the 16-acre disaster site, wind carried the chemical contaminants throughout the city of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens. This is the trailer for the new documentary, 9/11, Unsettled Dust.
Yeah, it seemed like it just sort of...
Once we saw the actual initial reports, we
just started realizing there was benzene being emitted. There was lead in the air. I was already getting warnings that there were many more potential toxic exposures.
When we heard Christy Todd-Whitman get on TV and say the air quality is safe, we were horrified.
The concentrations are such that they don't pose a health hazard. We're going to make sure everybody's safe.
You know, not only did we inhale and breathe in the air, we were drinking it and eating it. And I bitched and moaned to anybody who would listen to me.
My husband and I and other people who were engineers went down to the site, and there was no question that it was an unhealthy site.
They didn't have a mask in the beginning because some people were using Home Depot masks, even the guys at Ground Zero.
A 9/11 responded to the World Trade Center, breathing in all the toxic air, and they said it was safe to breathe.
We're talking about human life. We're talking about men that couldn't be here, that have traveled with me, the 80 trips that I made to D.C., that are laying in ICU or at home with IVs in them.
The first responders were told that the Drug Act would be included. They were told this last week. It'd be included in the transportation bill passed last week.
Not one of the first responders standing with me here today should have to be here today. Not one of them should have to take another trip to Washington.
This is about Washington, D.C., helping out people from 431 congressional districts that went to Ground Zero. New York wasn't attacked. This country was attacked.
That's the trailer for the new documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust, which premieres later this week on PBS stations in New York, New Jersey, and Long Island. For more, we're joined by Lisa Katzman, the film's director and producer. One of the key figures in the film is Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, who is not only co-host today, but his critical work at the beginning of the time after 9/11 just changed the landscape of how people understood what was happening near and around the pile. He and Joel Kupferman of the Environmental Law and Justice Project were among the first to expose the public health and environmental crisis at Ground Zero in a series of reports for the New York Daily News. Juan Gonzalez is also the author of the 2002 book Fallout: The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. So, Juan, we're beginning with you. I mean, that New York Daily News cover that caused so much outrage and response and attack on you, it was in October. It said exclusive, and we're going to show it right here. Toxic Zone was the headline. Levels of benzene, dioxin, PCBs, and other dangerous chemicals at Ground Zero exceed federal standards. That may not surprise people now, Juan, but you're the one who had it on the cover at a time when the EPA head was telling the country all was well in Lower Manhattan in terms of safety for people returning to work. Talk about how you came to understand how toxic Ground Zero was.
Well, Amy, I actually had started, I did an article about less than 3 weeks after the attack on the World Trade Center on September 28th, which began to talk about the high levels of asbestos that Joel Kupferman had discovered in his own independent testing that he had done around around Ground Zero, even as far down as Battery Park, very high levels of asbestos and of fiberglass, which ended up being actually responsible for much of the scarring of lungs that many of the first responders and other people downtown had. And so I'd actually done two articles before that big front page story. But then, of course, as Joel was able to get even more public records requests on health testing that had been hidden from the public, that big October 26 article, as I recall, was the one that laid out those findings. And the response was unbelievable. The backlash against it from the mayor's office, from the EPA, to the Daily News, to the point that actually my editors pulled back. They began after that beginning to hold my columns. And at one point, I actually had to go to the editor-in-chief at the time, a guy by the name of Ed Kosner. And I said, Ed, why are you holding up my follow-ups on this? And he says, well, you know, City Hall says this, and EPA says you're overstating the problem, you're sensationalizing, and the New York Times is not following our stories, and none of the other press are agreeing with us. And I said to him, well, since when do we depend on other media to tell us how to report what we find? So it became clear that the paper had been cowed by the Federalist and the city government. So I said to Kosner at the time, I said, Ed, you don't really know me. You just got here about a year ago, and I don't know you. So this is what I'm going to do. You run the paper. You're in charge of the paper, and I'm in charge of my column. So I'm going to keep writing about this issue because I don't want it on my conscience that 20 years later, people are going to start getting sick and dying because we didn't warn them of the potential health effects here. So I'm not going to stop writing about this. And the paper did end up killing some of my columns, but they ran most of them at the back of the page, at the back of the paper. My only mistake was believing that it would take 20 years for people to get sick. It actually took far less. Took about 5 years for the deaths and the severe illnesses to really become apparent. And by then, the paper had a new management, a new editor. And then the paper embarked, the editorial board embarked on a campaign to reveal the deaths and the illnesses that were occurring. And eventually it won the Pulitzer Prize. It was won the Pulitzer Prize, the editorial board, for its coverage of the health effects, the very health effects that 5 years earlier it had tried to squash. So history has a strange way of evolving on issues like this. And I think that it's a lesson that most media are very good at exposing problems far away. The closer the problems get to home, the more difficult it becomes to expose them.
You should have won the Pulitzer Prize for your series of prophetic reports. I wanted to go to David Newman with NICOSH. That's the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. He's speaking in the documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust.
There was substantial data available prior to the event that would indicate issues of concern with the collapse of the Twin Towers. One of those was the widely known and widely documented and widely advertised heavy use of asbestos during the construction of the World Trade Center project. So the figure that is in widespread circulation and uncontested is that there were 400 tons of asbestos used in sprayed on fireproofing material in the Trade Center construction. That figure excludes probable additional asbestos used in pipe insulation and other applications. So there's a huge amount. I think it's safe to say that whatever was in the World Trade Center was released into the general environment. Nothing disappeared.
Nothing disappeared. Whatever was inside the World Trade Towers became what we breathed. That's David Newman with the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health. And Juan, you talked about the New York Daily News winning the Pulitzer, but you didn't, and you should have. You were the one who led the way in exposing this. I wanted to bring in the director, Litza Katzman, director and producer of this utterly devastating documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Death. 9/11's Unsettled Dust. It could be Unsettled Deaths, and we're going to be talking about that in a minute. But talk about why you chose to make this film and the significance of a crusading reporter like Juan Gonzalez and others who were putting out this information going against the financial establishment. Let's remember who the country's mayor was at the time, Rudy Giuliani, the Environmental Protection Agency administrator, who now says, okay, maybe she made a mistake. She dreads the 9/11 anniversary because of this. Christine Todd Whitman saying everyone back to work.
Well, it's an honor to be on the show and
hello to both of you. Hi, Juan. It's good to hear you report on those first stories that you did again. Yes, the reason that I was drawn to make the film is I'm a member of, I live downtown. I live four blocks from the World Trade Centers and then what became Ground Zero. And I witnessed the recovery, the rescue and recovery effort through looking through my living room windows at it over a number of months. And it was very evident. Fortunately, at the time, I had a teaching job upstate, so I was not in my apartment on a full-time basis. But to anybody that lived here, who spent any time here or near downtown Manhattan, it defied one's senses and common sense to imagine that this wasn't a horrendously, I mean, off the charts environmental disaster. And so the statement that the air is safe, the denials that were made were utterly absurd. I mean, the level of disconnect from reality is almost legendary, I would say, at this point. It's really hard to fathom that those things were said. And the reason that I felt that I needed to make the film was to address that and to address the lack of accountability at the time. And then what ensued, you know, in the years afterward, is that that lack of accountability traveled through the courts. It traveled through the way that Republicans in Congress thought about what should be done to help first responders. And the same people that were always touting, never forget, never forget, and constantly reminding us of the heroism of these responders were unwilling to do anything to actually help them. And so the hypocrisy of that, the rage that I felt over that as time went on, led me to want to make this film, which I began doing in 2010, when the first responders were making they had been making trips to D.C. to pass the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act for some time. But there was an intensification of those efforts in 2010. And that's when I began filming.
I wanted to go to another part of the film. I mean, every 3 minutes, your jaw drops. This is the EPA's Hugh Kaufman and Kimberly Flynn, founder of 9/11 Environmental Action, speaking about the EPA's failure to warn people of the dangerous conditions at Ground Zero and perhaps why.
People told us, I'm not allowed to wear a respirator because there are cameras around and they don't want the optics of me wearing a respirator down here cleaning up.
Everyone came. Everyone who was affected came. There were responders. There were area workers. There were many, many residents and tenants association leaders. And there were scientists also who were bringing their information.
Christy Todd Whitman, the head of EPA, who was telling the people the air is safe to breathe, owned $250,000 in stock from Citigroup. And her husband worked for Citigroup. Travelers Insurance Company had insurance policies such that if the air wasn't safe to breathe, it could cost Travelers Insurance $500 million in claims. Well, guess who owns Travelers Insurance? Citigroup. And that's how the insurance company saved billions of dollars by Christy Todd Whitman's lie.
Juan, talk about the significance of this, the personal financial connections, what this meant for so many people and continues to mean for the sick and the dying today.
Well, Amy, I think people should remember that Christy Todd Whitman did not act alone. She basically was acting under orders. And it was later revealed, I think, by the Treasury Secretary under the Bush administration that George Bush had, the president at the time, had directly ordered that Wall Street be reopened within a week of the attacks because there was a fear in the administration that the continued closing of the financial markets was going to have a disastrous effect on world capitalism. So basically, once Bush ordered that the Wall Street be reopened, then that meant that thousands and thousands of financial industry workers had to come back to downtown Manhattan. Then the health officials, including Christy Todd Whitman, had to justify, had to justify the orders. And rather than do the science first and then figure out what the policy was established and the science was made to fit the facts. It was later revealed by the EPA's Inspector General report that the White House, the head of the environmental policy at the White House, a guy by the name of James Connison, had actually rewritten the press releases that the EPA was putting out to downplay the health impact. So this was a direct order from the White House to get Wall Street back up and running. And the rest of the population of lower Manhattan basically, in essence, were collateral damage to that policy.
This is President George W. Bush's EPA Administrator, Christine Todd Whitman, testifying at a 2007 congressional hearing on whether the federal government's actions at the 9/11 attack sites, at the pile, violated the rights of first responders and local residents.
I got a call from the White House a day after from the Office of the Economic Advisor, which is not surprising. They're concerned about the economy of the country, saying, reminding me of the importance of the Wall Street, of opening the stock market. I indicated that until that building was cleaned, until it was safe, it would be inappropriate. And that's the last I heard of that. It was cleaned. It was safe, as you have heard from Mr. Henshaw, for them to go back in. And they were allowed back in. Was it wrong to try to get the city back on its feet as quickly as possible in the safest way possible? Absolutely not. Safety was first and foremost. But we weren't going to let the terrorists win.
We weren't going to let the terrorists win. During the hearing, Whitman was questioned by Florida Democratic Congressmember Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
The EPA did have the ability to take over the site at the point that they felt that, and that is under Presidential Decision Directive 62, Emergency Support Function 10, and the National Contingency Plan under CERCLA, the EPA could have taken over control of the site from the city as the lead agency if they felt that the city was not properly protecting their workers. So they certainly had the ability to do it, and you chose not to. So if you are saying that the law wasn't structured in New York to allow you to do that, then why didn't EPA step in and take over?
Congresswoman, under, as you know, EPA would have, under certain circumstances, had the authority to take over the site. What had to be proven in order to invoke the CERCLA, the Superfund Act, substantial and imminent danger. And the readings that we were getting relative, and this was relative to the overall air, I'm talking more about outside of the pile, were not indicating that, and we were working in a collegial fashion with the city of New York. Again, as far as the workers on the pile, we were tasked by OSHA to do by FEMA to do the health and safety monitoring, to monitor the air, and we did that, and then we provided as many respirators.
You,
we
were, you know, not when it comes
with,
to imminent, substantial and imminent danger, are you talking about immediate death, horrible sickness within weeks? Because mesothelioma, the cancer that is the right result of exposure to asbestos, does not manifest itself substantially or immediately. It could be years, but it's almost certain. So how is it that you didn't step in and exercise your authority, given that knowledge, which has been known for years?
The gentlelady's time has expired. The witness may answer the question.
Congresswoman, that was based on what the interpretation of what our legal ability was to act by, in consultation with counsel at the time.
And that was Jerry Nadler, New York Congressmember, who represented the Ground Zero area, chairing the meeting. Christine Todd Whitman being questioned by Florida Democratic Congressmember Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Before we go to break, and then hear the story of Joe Zadroga, you may think you know it because his name is on the law. but I don't think you know the details. Juan, your comment on what Christine Todd Whitman was saying and the information that was being suppressed from the highest levels. Nadler would go on to say that she and America's mayor, Mayor Giuliani, should be tried for criminal negligence.
Well, I think it's important to recall the role of Rudy Giuliani as well, because you see, the EPA was a monitoring agency, the federal agency that should have assured the protection of all the people at Ground Zero was OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And OSHA deliberately did not enforce its standards for working on a dangerous site like that, because Giuliani insisted that he was in charge. He was the incident commander on the pile, and he maintained his control of all information and all activity at the pile long after what it should have been just a rescue operation. So therefore, OSHA was not allowed by Mayor Giuliani to actually conduct its legally required business. And as a result, many, many people ended up being exposed and getting sick and not having proper protection. And we should never forget the role of Rudy Giuliani allowing that situation to go on for so long.
And that was very different at the Pentagon, which was also attacked, where they had the proper attire. We're going to talk with Joe Zadroga in a minute. The bill is the James Zadroga Act. His son, who has since died. Stay with us. Hunting We Will Go, performed by the O'Neill Brothers. It was sung by Michael Williams in The Wire, well known for that. Michael Williams, who has died at the age of 54 in Brooklyn. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we spend the hour looking at the outraging film, 9/11's Unsettled Us, the powerful documentary following the 9/11 responders and other survivors who had to fight for health care justice while they were sick. In this clip, we hear Joe Zadroga discuss his son, James, a 9/11 responder, and then New York Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney.
My son, Jimmy, who was an NYPD detective, he was actually sick as soon as he got home. 3 months after the event, I said to him, you know, let's go to Columbian Presbyterian Hospital and go talk to, you know, the pulmonologist, the head pulmonologist in Columbian Presbyterian. And I took him. We went to the hospital. The doctor sat with him for an hour or so and examined him and told us to come back in 2 weeks. Well, when we came back in 2 weeks, the doctor brought us into his office with his nice cushioned chairs and everything and sat us down and just said, Jimmy, I'm not going to treat you. And we were shocked. And we said, what do you mean you're not going to treat him? He said, no, I'm not going to treat him. And he got up and walked out. And, you know, we were a little dumbfounded. And we looked at each other. We couldn't understand why this doctor wouldn't treat him. And as we were going down the elevator, I said to Jimmy, this is going to be a long process. I said, and tell you the truth, you're screwed. They're not going to take care of you. You know, the department treated him terrible. The department refused to admit that he was sick. And they just persecuted him. And they wouldn't give up. They really wanted him to quit. They would send a sergeant to the house to make sure he was in the house because they were hoping to catch him outside the house where they could discipline him and probably fire him. That's how much they wanted to get rid of him, to say that he wasn't sick. Jimmy died January 6, 2006. Found him up in his bedroom with his little daughter sleeping on bed. He got up during the night to get her a bottle, and I found him on the floor with the bottle in his hand. The baby sleeping. Fortunately, we were in New Jersey, and the Ocean County Medical Examiner did a post on him. And the post came back. The doctor stated on the medical report that Jimmy died from working at Ground Zero on 911, that he had the dust particles in his lungs, and that's what he passed away from. Of course, the city wouldn't admit to that. Bloomberg came on the air and said with his medical examiner that who was this New Jersey medical examiner to say that this person, he wouldn't even call him an officer, that this person died from 911. So when we went to the medical examiner's office, I brought a picture of Jimmy. I said, listen, we're not talking about an object here. We're talking about my son. And I want you to look at that picture when you talk about him. He turned around and said, listen, I want you, your family, to drop that saying that he died from 911. If you don't drop that he died from 911, I will go to the press and I will say that James used his drugs illegally and he died from misusing his drugs.
It became so nasty with so many headlines that were derogatory towards James Adroga that some people came to me and said, Carolyn, change the title of the bill. It's too controversial. Everyone believes that Zadroga was a dope addict. I said, if I change it to whoever the next name is, they'll say, do the same thing to them. He wasn't a dope addict. He was a first responder. He served at 9/11, and we should stick with the Zadroga name.
We should stick with the Zadroga name. That was Congressmember Carolyn Maloney of New York in the documentary 9/11's Unsettled Dust, which is premiering this week. We are joined now by Joe Zadroga, who you've just been watching or listening to, the father of the NYPD police detective James Zadroga, who died of a respiratory illness after assisting in rescue efforts at Ground Zero. Joe, we didn't see your son year after year, either in a wheelchair or with oxygen or with crutches going to Washington. This parade of people who were victims of 9/11, of their own government, because he died in 2006. But Carolyn Maloney stuck with your son being the name on the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act. Can you talk about what this means to you and who is covered and what you went through at the end trying to get Jimmy help?
Well, yeah, we spent 5 years trying to get Jimmy help medically, to the politicians, to the newspapers, to the radio, to the TV stations. Everyone refused to help us. They would deny us access. When he went to the hospital, the doctors would want to treat him. They wanted to treat him, and they said they would take good care of him. He was a 9/11 responder. They'd take good care of him. And then 2 days later, they discharged him. Obviously, it was from the it wasn't from the doctors. It was from the administration, from the hospitals, telling them to get him out and you know, let him go home and die. More or less, that's what they were saying. And we went on for 5 years trying that. I mean, we went to everybody, and it was very frustrating, and it took a toll on you know, on the family. Took a toll, obviously, on Jimmy. Jimmy felt that, you know, they just let him out to die, more or less. The police department wouldn't do anything for him. As it said previously, they were trying to get rid of him. They wanted him to go out on a general disability just to get rid of him. And I told Jimmy to refuse a general disability. That was definitely a job connected injury, and to stay for the fight. And we stayed for the fight, and eventually they did let him out on a job-related injury. They didn't say it was directly resulted from 9/11, but they let him out. And more or less, you know, they just wanted to get rid of him. And that's how it went. And he was on oxygen. I mean, you could sit and watch with your child who was a healthy 30-year-old man deteriorate down to sitting on oxygen 24/7. His wife passed away from the stress of watching him die. In the early part, we did go to one doctor in Westchester. Actually, Jimmy was friends with all the firemen because he worked street crimes citywide, so he used to go to the firehouses to eat. So I just told him to ask the firemen who they go to for their lung problems. And they gave him a doctor in Westchester. And mind you, this was within 3 months after the event. And he went to the doctor in Westchester. The doctor examined him. And at the examination, the doctor told him, 3 years you're going to be blind. 5 years you're going to be dead. And he died in 5 years.
And our condolences, because even though it was 2006, I know how incredibly hard this is for you on this 20th anniversary, Joe. What is it, 15 years later? Yes, this week marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and we're spending the hour looking at the massive environmental and public health crisis that followed at Ground Zero in New York, and how politicians from the president to the EPA head, Christine Todd Whitman, the president, of course, Bush, prioritized Wall Street's interests in the aftermath. Another person who knows this story so well is joining us now, Lila Nordstrom. She was a student at Stuyvesant High School in 2001, which is right next to the World Trade Center towers that collapsed. In the new documentary, 9/11 The Unsettled Dust, she explains how the school quickly reopened despite health concerns. She also tells the story in her new book, just out, Some Kids Left Behind, A Survivor's Fight for Healthcare in the Wake of 9/11. She's executive director of Stuy Health. Lila, welcome to Democracy Now! Still with us, Lisa Katzman, the director of the film. For people to understand what happened at your school after the attack, and how the site was used as you kids tried to go to school.
I mean, I think that the thing to understand is that our school wasn't just next to the World Trade Center site, but we were also in the center of the cleanup operations. So we got sent back to school at a time that the neighborhood was not yet open to the public. We went through 5 police checkpoints on our first day of school on October 9th, which is less than a month after the attacks. Our school building hadn't been adequately cleaned. None of the venting had been cleaned. When they actually did clean the venting the following summer, there were inches thick of World Trade Center dust in our school vents. But also the barge that they were bringing all of the debris to from the site that was taking it to Fresh Kills was located right next to our school thanks to a waiver that was signed by George Pataki, the governor then, that allowed them to essentially place a toxic waste dump next to a public school. And one thing to keep in mind is that our school was also next to BMCC, so we were next to a community college. There were thousands of students that were attending school there in that period, and there were not any safety precautions being taken to protect us as we walked to and from school. The building that we were attending school in smelled like smoke, you know, 24 hours a day for the entire length of time. And we were there for 9 months of the cleanup operations starting in early October.
And Lila, what were the parents told? Because I remember reporting on the head of the Parents Association at that time. And we're talking about the best high school in the city of New York. And Marilena Cristodulo, she was constantly battling with school officials and being told that everything was safe. And yet test results inside of Stuyvesant High School were showing abnormally high levels of lead and other contaminants.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, this was an ongoing conversation. It began as soon as we got back because, you know, the Parents Association found that we had really been misled about what the safety of the conditions in the school would be when we returned. So we were told that they would be installing these HEPA filters in the, you know, in the school air system, and that you know, they had spent $1 million cleaning the school, and that just seemed like a large sum. They kept throwing out that number as if that was like a meaningful indication of how safe things were. And when we got back, the parents found that, A, you know, the surrounding area was not yet safe for habitation. And so, of course, the school wasn't safe for habitation. But also, a lot of the things that they had said they would do to protect the air inside of the school had not actually been done. And so the Parents Association and the Board of Ed kind of embarked on this contentious journey where they would each hire their own, you know, air quality experts to examine the air quality. And they were, you know, they were kind of calling each other's results into question. Meanwhile, though, you know, almost immediately upon our return, students started getting nosebleeds and headaches, and, you know, a chronic cough was, I would say, going around, but it wasn't a contagious chronic cough. It was just from the air. The school nurses line was backed up. Even the New York Times reported that no one could get in to see a school nurse at Stuyvesant. And as in that very article, as they are telling, you know, as they're reporting that you know, that no one can get in to see a nurse, and there's widespread, you know, respiratory issues going on in the school, the Board of Ed is saying, yeah, but don't worry, there's not going to be any long-term consequences to this.
Lila, we only have a few minutes, yeah. And I just want to make sure, you know, an HBO doc is coming out this week, documentary about you, about the Stuyvesant High kids. It does not mention this issue of the environmental health. And one of the people featured is a woman named Catherine Choi. You write about this in the New York Daily News. And at the very, very, very end of the doc, it mentions, oh, and she died of cancer. It doesn't say 9/11 related cancer, but how this has been whited out of the history.
Yeah. And I mean, that was an incredibly frustrating realization because she, you know, the federal government presumes that any of the cancers that are on their list of covered conditions are 9/11 linked. So it's not a stretch to say that her cancer was 9/11 related. That's something the federal government would acknowledge. And so the fact that that was omitted from a story that was basically used to exploit a narrative about unity after 9/11 that we did not feel or experience, and that we have become victims of a narrative that, you know, sort of excludes the non-unity piece of that story, has been incredibly frustrating. And it's an ongoing struggle that we face in terms of, you know, not just seeing our stories reflected in media, but also, you know, seeing our sort of access to these programs as valid, seeing our story as one that entitles us to the services that first responders have as well. And so a lot of the time survivors don't even think that they qualify. They don't believe, you know, that they went through anything. And so they've never seen their story reflected anywhere in a way that validates that it's dangerous.
Lisa Katzman, you have an amazing documentary. Your final words in the last 20 seconds. We never allow for sound bites. We say we want the whole meal, but this time.
I think that the takeaway of this film is that this issue of lack of accountability that our political leaders have, I think that 9/11 is the beginning of a period of history where we see an increase of this. We saw it in the BP disaster. We even see it in the way the egregious way that masking was handled during the COVID times, where, you know, FEMA was completely corrupted.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for this remarkable documentary. It's called 9/11's Unsettled Us, directed by Lisa Katzman. Lila Nordstrom, your new book, Some Kids Left Behind, is Joe Zadroga, father of NYPD Detective James Zadroga, and the remarkable, should have won the Pulitzer Prize, Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.